Welcome to DLC, your downloadable content for the week. DLC delivered the way it's meant to be, completely free, and that is thanks to our sponsors this week, MailChimp and New Relic. They made that possible. DLC, of course, is the show all about gaming in its many forms. Games played on integrated circuits, games played on tables. I'm Jeff Cannata, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host slash nemesis, the Joker to my Batman, Christian Spicer.
Hey everybody, welcome to Ducks Like Chicken. I'm really excited to be here. I have a lot of stuff to talk about cross-poultry eating conventions, and it's been a busy week.
Yeah, we're coming at you hard and fast today, and every Monday, of course, because as @_funks pointed out on Twitter, DLC is delivered like cannonballs. We are also thrilled to welcome our very first guest on our very second episode of DLC, the awesome, the amazing Anthony Carboni from Rev3 Games and Test Tube.
Yay.
Hi, guys. Well, thank you for having me.
Dude, Anthony, I have been a fan of his for a long time. We were sort of co-workers at Revision 3 when I was there, although I was down in LA, he was up in San Francisco, so we just sort of pined away for each other across the expanse of California.
It was like the Somewhere Out There sequence in American Tale.
Yes.
Kind of.
But you have...
We were sad, but we knew that we were sharing the same bright sky.
That's right. You have launched a whole mess of new awesome shows recently, my favorite of which is Hard Science. That show is just pure fun.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, that's a really fun one. Yeah, we sold out real hard. Discovery bought us, and now we get to do a bunch of really cool things. So we started a whole new science channel, and Tara Long, who's also on Rev3 Games, she used to host the Destructoid show. She and I do like really crazy big experiments every week. I basically just try to kill myself, and then we have a science advisor off camera who tries to remind me not to kill myself, and that's how the show works.
It's just like little kids in a playground. I love watching that. I love the quicksand episode, which is basically just like, can we drive a bike across Jell-O? Which was a lot. Awesome.
That was fun because we had to go to a restaurant supply store. We made like a non-Newtonian fluid. So it's like 2 parts cornstarch, 1 part water. So we had to go to a restaurant supply store and buy a 1/2 ton of cornstarch. And just like, you just like throw down a company card and you're like, I'll take 1,000 pounds of cornstarch, please.
That is awesome. Well, we are going to maybe add a little science into the show, but mostly we're going to be talking about games today. And guess what, folks? You get to join in on the conversation. You can call 512-518-5714 and get on the line, and you can ask us questions, talk about the topics we're talking about. Again, 512-518-5714. That is when we are broadcasting live, which is every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific time. You can also hang out in our chat. The IRC is at 5by5.tv/live. There's a whole mess of folks hanging out there right now, and they're awesome. Look at all these guys talking. Someone says, I can't hear the podcast, so that's fun. No, we got a lot of folks hanging out in the chat room. Call us in. But the first thing we're going to do, you know, we launched the show last week on Wednesday. So this is kind of a short week because the vicissitudes of the internet required us to launch the show and on our non-regularly scheduled time. But we will be on Mondays from now on. So we got a short week, but we're still going to do the story of the week, which leads me to the theme song, which goes like this. Story of the week, it's the story of the week. Story of the week, it's the story of the week. All right, guys.
I wish I had a juice harp to go along with that, I think. Like a didgeridoo or something. I feel like would go real well with that.
You didn't get the didgeridoo that I sent you?
Did you send it to the office or did you send it to my home?
Well, I figured you'd need it at your home more than anything else for the lonely nights.
Send it to the office next time. If you have any rain sticks, didgeridoos, or juice harps.
Sweet.
I love the way, Jeff, that you came. You're able to come right out of that song straight into just regular back podcast voice. Of course, we, you know, Anthony and I totally derailed it by commenting on it, but you were just singing. All right, now the first story, it's just seamless.
No, Christian,
I feel like
that
that's my goal as first guest, is to see how often I can derail, like see how much this format is actually set in stone right now. I hope you guys did a lot of test runs.
Guys, that is me tossing to the pre-recorded bumper music and then coming out of pre-recorded bumper music back into the show. That's how a professional radio program does it. And that is, of course, what we are.
Of course.
Anyway, story of the week.
Jeff does it
segment
in his mirror every morning.
What's that?
It's also how you do it in your mirror every morning when you're practicing.
Yeah, the rehearsal period for the show is intense and frequent. The story of the week segment, of course, is where we convince each other of what the most important gaming story of the week is. We got a lot of options this, well, fewer options than normal because we're a shortened week, but there's still some stuff going down. Anthony, do you have a pick for something that you think was important that happened in the last few days?
Yeah, I mean, you guys sent along some suggestions to me, and there's some good stuff. I want to talk about this SimCity offline mode, though. Mm-hmm. I really do.
Yeah, this drives me nuts. This just broke. Go ahead.
SimCity broke a long time ago. Yeah, SimCity started off broken and has just hobbled along. This you know, last year when SimCity launched, they said the same thing. They said EA said with Diablo, which is you can't do it offline. There's no way to do it offline. Has to be persistent online because of how complex it is and because we're doing entire cities and weather. No, it's offline now. It was so broken. Yeah. They were like, no, we can do it offline. They finally just admitted that what they were doing was DRM, which is what they said they were not doing.
Integral to the experience of the new SimCity. You guys don't understand. It's integral to the, we can't create the game we want to make unless you're constantly logged in, guys.
The game has to connect to our tilt shift servers to add the adorable Twee effects to this game. Otherwise, you just can't do that in real time. You need cloud computing.
Well, it's certainly very interesting that, you know, and also they said significant engineering would be required to, you know, take the game into an offline mode. So evidently they've spent the last 10 months putting in that significant engineering. And now it's offline, which, of course, I applaud the fact that they recognized that was a problem, listened to their audience of what the audience wanted and put it in. The question is it too little too late? Christian Spicer, I'm going to guess you're going to say yes.
It cuts both ways, right? Like the optimist in me says kudos to them. They said it would take, like you said, a long time to do, and maybe it did. Let's take them at their word, which I know is easy to not do when it comes to games and gaming companies, but maybe they have been spending the last 10 months trying to engineer a way to make this work. So one, it's awesome because if you haven't played the game, now is arguably the best time to go in and see if you like it for what it is. I think some people will still have problems with it because of the smaller city sizes and things like that. But, you know, more options are there. Is this going to, in my opinion, do I think that this change will see a large spike in sales for the game and popular opinion shifting? Will Polygon change their review score again? No, I don't think so. I think we're going to have a discussion about it. A few other video game podcasts might talk about it. And then I think it's done. I do think it's too little too late. And it's a shame because SimCity is that franchise that, you know, the hardest of hardcore gamers like and the most casual gamers can all get behind. And it's just been sad to see this game not live up to whatever, what was it, 3 years ago, E3, when they first showed it? And oh my gosh, it looked so good.
Yeah, that was my game of E3 that year. And yeah, it was a disappointment coming out and being broken, as everybody has pointed out. I'd like to tie this into the decision that we all saw Microsoft make with regard to the Xbox One of sort of 180 degreeing on their position of always online as well. Is this representative of a sea change that we'll see? Will there be fewer games that require always online? Will these companies be gun shy to sort of make that requirement? What do you guys think?
Well, I think the thing that companies need to come to terms with and need to be a little more upfront with is that in a lot of cases for these persistently connected games, it is a DRM decision. It is a rights management decision. And all of these games that are persistently online, I mean, unless it's an MMO or something like that, I haven't seen any always on games that truly justify being always on.
So you're just saying, just be upfront with us. Don't couch it in, oh, we want to make the game better, this is why we're doing it. Just straight up say, we don't want you to trade this illegally.
Yeah. And, you know, I think once we get to a point where there is a better infrastructure, particularly in the United States for internet, and companies get better at building these giant back-end servers, like maybe you can have an always-on game that works well enough, and then we won't care as much. I think the problem is any failure in an always-online game right now that breaks it, if those always-online features don't justify it, then the first time it breaks, you lose all consumer confidence. So now it becomes a business decision rather than a gameplay decision. And until they can either create a game that convinces me it needs to be always online, or fix this back-end infrastructure, or wait for our own countrywide infrastructure to get better, I just don't see how always online is going to work. Even last weekend when PSN was intermittently down, all the games that we had at the office on our office PS4, we couldn't play any of them, even though we had purchased them and downloaded them. Even handshaking right now is precarious.
So Anthony,
well, also the germs that you get from handshaking. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
Anthony, you mentioned, you know, until the features justify an always online requirement, and I'm assuming, and just to say it, but we're not talking about multiplayer games, right? I mean, this isn't including WoW and things like that.
Exactly. Well, not an MMO, not something like a Call of Duty multiplayer or a Battlefield multiplayer, which is broken enough on its own right now.
But then online is intrinsic in what that thing is. I think what you're talking about, and just to be clear though, is like, you know, games where people expect a single player experience or expect to be able to sit on their computer or console and just play a game. But then my question is, what type of features would they add that would make you think it's justified? Like you personally, like what gets you excited? Would it be the promise of cloud computing and having better graphics than you can otherwise run? Or do you think there, at this point, there isn't anything that would get you jazzed up about that?
I don't think anybody's really showed me something yet that makes me excited for an always online. I think one thing that's particularly a couple things that are coming up in the future sound kind of interesting, but they're not going to require a persistent connection, just an occasional internet check-in and handshake. One is No Man's Sky, the one that Hello Games is working on.
Yeah,
where everybody is in the same persistent galaxy, so connecting to the star map and sharing data between people exploring this galaxy is going to be interesting. And the other one is Sunset Overdrive, which is going to have a city that changes and gives different challenges and different items and things like that every day, even in the single player. So
yeah,
those
I'm
kinds of things,
that-
I'm like, okay, connect to the internet, but maybe not all the time and maybe don't require it.
Yeah, you know? I'm convinced that this generation is going to be the generation where that line is blurred farther than it ever has been. I mean, I think you're seeing games, even in the first wave of next-gen games, over and over, it's like The Division and Destiny and all these games where they would have been single-player experiences in the past, but now it's sort of this space that is, yeah, it's your story, you're in this world. It's not really an MMO, but you are always going to be interacting and getting information and giving information to a greater online community. And I mean, I think even that was the ostensibly that was the reason for SimCity and Diablo and these games that were marquee always on failure games. That was ostensibly the reason that they wanted them to be online, or at least the reason they gave to the gaming public, you know. And I would say, had there not been these connectivity issues, I mean, maybe SimCity not so much because the sort of size of the game and other things were at issue with that game, but at least with Diablo 3, I felt that was a very compelling kind of experience to be able to drop in and drop out and always have that experience. Yes, this was a traditionally single-player game, and yes, it kind of sucked that we couldn't have a single-player experience per se, but had it worked, I'm not so sure it would have been seen so negatively.
I mean, that's true, but there's also, you know, there are some people that don't want to be persistently always online, right?
Yeah.
I am more often a single-player gamer than I am a multiplayer gamer. And for something like Diablo, for me, especially since I had not been like a huge Diablo player in the past, I would have loved the ability to just single player my way through something to decide whether I was proficient enough to go online, whether it was something that I wanted to stick with and go online. You know what I mean? And they didn't really give a great reason as to why that couldn't have been thrown in there, other than, you know, kind of from their perspective, they didn't want people, you know, they said they didn't want people cheating. They didn't want people gaming the auction house. You know, there was real money at stake now, and that I understand, but I don't understand why I couldn't have had a single player character and then an online character.
To be fair, you could. I mean, I soloed Diablo 3 as an ambulance comes by to collect my corpse. I soloed Diablo 3 and I just, you know, I was technically online, but I set it so that no one could come into my game.
Sure.
So while it was annoying to have to play that way, you know, make sure whatever, internet's up or blah, blah, blah. I mean, in terms of playing it as a single player game, it was still there. I think that their justification then for my type of gaming was the auction house stuff and, you know, the gold. But I don't know. I mean, I think it was Jeff, you said if it worked, then no one would have been upset. Well, yeah. I mean, I agree, but that also feel like, you know, that makes me laugh because it's like, well, if it was awesome, we all would have thought it was awesome.
Well, it's not about it being awesome. I mean, I think that we can separate the sort of gameplay application of the always on connectivity with the execution of it. I mean, I don't think anybody is going to say, well, you know, this works because it hasn't yet. But I don't think we can also say that there won't be a time when they'll figure it out. I mean, I think that's inevitable. At some point, somebody's going to be able to launch a game well, you know, that requires this. But it's interesting. In the chat room, we have Jay Geogan, who said he lives in New York City, and even in New York City, he can't guarantee that he'll have internet more than about 90% of the time. So like 10% of his time, he's not even able to log on to things. So that's a problem, too.
Oh, dude, when I was in New York, the internet in New York is the worst internet in the world. So I feel for him.
Interesting.
It was the slowest internet that I have ever had in my life. You get to these giant city centers where a lot of people want to play these games, and you think that they're going to have like these massively interesting and fast high tech internet connections, and they usually don't because they're just built over this old infrastructure of city wires and city lines. I mean, that's my thing is I just wonder when we're going to have consistent enough internet connection where we can always be persistently online with games.
Yeah, and this relates to one of the stories that you pointed out this week, Christian, which is the Capcom saying that all of their games will be, quote, social in the future, that there will be some sort of social functionality to every Capcom game soon, you know? And, of course, everybody interprets that as being, well, it's DRM, it's microtransactions, it's, you know, all the sort of negative things, but and it may very well be, I'm not discounting those fears, but I also think that everybody from the development side, I think, are excited about this level of connectivity that we're getting to where, you know, like in Burnout, you know, where you can constantly see who's got the fastest lap time or fastest street time here or whatever, that there's constantly this information flow that's happening that makes even single player experiences feel connected.
Yeah, I just think that, and so, you know, after Capcom said this, I believe it was an investor call, you know, it wasn't a press release type thing, but, you know, the internet went crazy and got upset. And I kind of understand that. I think Capcom just, these are the type of declarative statements and definites that you just don't make, right? Like if this were an improv scene or something and someone says they'll all be social, that you jump on that all. Or if this was a legal argument and someone said always, that's what you key in on. And I think that's what people are doing here. It's like, why do you put yourself out there and say that you're always going to do this? Like, just make your games. And if they have these hooks, they have these hooks. But it's like, you know, when EA said that all our games are going to have Project $10, and now they don't anymore. And people got upset because they're like, we don't want this on all our games. You're trying to shove this down our throats and we're not, you know, we don't support it, blah, blah, blah. I think if you just did stuff, like if EA just introduced Project $10 and a bunch of their games, and if Capcom just starts implementing these social hooks in their games, you know, and if they're responded to well, like you mentioned, you know, how Criterion and Burnout and now the Need for Speed games, and even before that, like Geometry Wars had these cool social hooks, no one cared. But I think people get afraid when it's this big company saying that it's like a corporate mandate that all their games are going to have this. It sounds like, I guess I said it, a corporate mandate instead of a design decision. And I think that's what gets me afraid as a gamer, is that they're going to sacrifice gameplay to make sure they toe this company line, and then the pessimist to bolster the revenue stream. And that mm-hmm. that sucks, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think there is there's a wealth of different definitions now for what social is in gaming, right? And I think the reason people got scared is, like you said, things like leaderboards and comparative scores like that are not something that the standard player thinks about as social anymore. They're kind of just these, built-in things that are expected. And social, because of all of the Zynga sort of stuff and the free-to-play sort of stuff that's been out there for so long, social has taken on the connotation of, like, well, if you want to take another turn, why don't you message this out to 20 Facebook friends? So the term itself has become sort of toxic, you know, and it's one of those, like, things that gets a player's hackles up to the point where you can't even have a rational discussion about social anymore. But when you think about social, I tend to think about things like Drivatars in Forza, right? Like, that's the coolest social gaming that I've seen in a really long time. And it's really changed racing games for me.
Or as Lawman points out in the IRC, social equals Demon Souls and Dark Souls. Like, that kind of social is really cool too, you know? Let's take a call. We got somebody on the line from the 949. We are live. Are you there, caller? Hi. Ooh, wait, hang on. There it is. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, very cool.
What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, guys. Good to see ya.
Well, good.
You it's can Adam see us from Australia.
I know I should have turned my webcam off. Dang it. You're calling from Australia.
Hello. Hang on, I can't hear you.
You gotta turn your radio down. That's what they always say on Sports Talk. Turn your radio down. Yeah, you gotta turn your radio down.
Australia was the future. It seems like Australia is 2 seconds in the past.
Yeah.
I can't seem to hear you on this line, though.
So. How do you like
that? Oh, okay. Okay.
Oh, are you there? Oh, we lost him. I think we got some.
Somebody you guys
else.
Have a solid Australian following. I was noticing that last week too.
We do. Well, it's what is it like? It's like
we're trying to get rid of it as we take their calls and then hang up on them.
Yeah.
I think it's like, was like 3 o'clock tomorrow contingent. There right now.
If that was true, why did you mail me a didgeridoo to my house?
Yeah. We're just trying to get that Australian contingent. I feel like there's somebody online from the 949 right now. Can you hear us? Working out the kinks. Working out the kinks. All right. We got, if you want to call in, 512-518-5714. You're going
to
have to.
Up on you also.
Well, but the thing is, you got to, you know, either wear earphones or turn down your stream when you're listening to us. The cool thing is when you call in, that you'll hear the show while you're on hold through your phone. So all you have to do is use your cell phone. You don't have to have the show playing through your speakers on your computer. I should have probably been clear about that. But again, 512-518-5714. All right, Christian, what is your story of the week, contender?
My story of the week, which is the story of the week, is that there's apparently a Ridley Scott-produced Halo movie coming, and it's been kept secret for a while, but now it's been leaked through breakdowns.
Uh-huh.
What the crap? This has me excited. I feel like I just heard about Prometheus for the first time. Again, I didn't like Prometheus, but when I first heard about it...
We're focusing on the first time. First time.
The reveal in the first IMAX trailer. That's how I feel right now. I think Ridley Scott could do an amazing Halo movie. They've been working on it. Don't get me wrong. I think that Peter Jackson could have also done a great one, but... this is what I want to see. The Halo TV series, as of now, I'm not interested in. I want big space opera. I want epic, huge shots of little ships or big ships that look little in a vast sea of space. And I want weight behind Master Chief walking on foreign soils. And that stuff that Ridley Scott has done so well historically in his movies. And if this is real, I think this could be awesome.
All right, let me tell you like 12 reasons why you're wrong about this being a story.
Make it 13 and you've got a deal.
First of all, the story is Ridley Scott produced, which
yeah,
means
I know.
Yeah. So it's his scot-free production company, which means, you know, there's nothing about him directing it, right? Which is also how Peter Jackson was not going to direct it. It was going to be Neil Blomkamp. Anyway, okay. Second of all, this isn't going to happen. Third of all,
a reason for why it won't happen can't be because it won't happen.
No, I agree. That was a cheap shot. But let me just say this. Last week, you got pissed at me for saying that my story of the week was new information about the Oculus. And you're like, it can only be story of the week when it's like, Oculus is happening. It's coming out. I can buy it at the store tomorrow. So this is complete hypocrisy from you, Spicer, because this is so not Halo is being released, go see it, or even Halo is being made, or even there's a script. It's just some dude on Twitter wrote something about how potentially Ridley Scott might be involved with a possible Halo movie at some time someday in our future.
Well, way to spoil next week's story of the week, which is Christian Spicer is a hypocrite and doesn't care.
There was even in the article here, it says like it's based on this round and round game of Twitter telephone. Like nobody can track it back to the actual original source. So this is basically
Christian wants Ridley Scott to make Halo really bad. And
I see a phone call from 310 in here. Is this from Hollywood? Is this Ridley Scott on the line? Ridley, what can you say? Hey guys, I'm making a Halo movie. It's going to be dope. Awesome. Thanks, Ridley. Thanks for the confirmation. Wow, guys, an exclusive DLC confirmation. Story of the week.
All right, I think we got our caller back. Dare I try? We got a bunch of guys on the line here, but I'm going to try to take our first call. Here we go. Are you there, caller? Hi. Mm-hmm. Are you there?
Yes, this is Neil Blomkamp.
Neil Blomkamp.
I can't even do a weird South African accent. I can't do it.
Hey, there it is. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. What's your name and where you're calling from? Mm-hmm. Working just as smooth as butter. No, not happening. Phone's not working. Somebody.
Steve from Costa Mesa.
Steve from Costa Mesa. What's up, Steve? What's your opinion on Story of the Week and or the stuff we've been talking about?
Sorry, guys. There seems to.
I think.
There seems to be a lag of when I talk versus when you hear me, so
okay, well, try to time it. It's like we're playing jump rope, double dutch. Go ahead and begin.
All right, so I'll talk as much as I can. Story of the week with Ridley Scott, I can't say that I'm really thrilled about his work, but you know, I mean, he did the best he could do with Prometheus, but, you know, it was a disappointment. So, I don't know. I mean, and the Halo movie is kind of long overdue, but.
Agreed. I agree. I don't agree with you that. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Sorry about the lag and delay. I don't agree that Ridley Scott's career is disappointing. I mean,
Alien, Blade Runner, Gladiator, Robin Hood,
The Good Wife.
Actually, yeah. What was that movie he did with Russell Crowe that was like he inherits a building in London or in the countryside of France, and that was really charming. And it was just like this small little romantic comedy that he did.
A good year.
Very good, right?
Yeah.
Very good. Okay, we're gonna try. I'm gonna glutton for punishment, so I'm gonna try another call. This is from 301 area code. Please work. It worked so well last week. Are you there, caller? Hi. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, it looks like we're having issues with our system here. I apologize for that. We're going to get that worked out. But in the meantime, I will go ahead and say what I think the story of the week is, which is Sony is doing what is basically a Steam sale. And if you're listening to this live, it starts tomorrow. The 14th, they're doing 14 for 14, which is 2014. They're putting 14 games on sale, actually 28. 14 for PS3 and 14 for the Vita. I'm surprised Christian Spicer as the big Vita fanboy that you are, that you weren't all over this as your story of the week, because this is the dream we all dreamed for the new consoles, which is that they will do variable pricing and make flash sales like Steam does.
It's the world we've been living in for months now, though. Sony's been doing these all the time and they've been great. This isn't a story. This is like, hey, they're doing another one. Like for PlayStation Plus members, you get crazy good prices on board with the best Steam flash prices. And for non-Plus members, you still get pretty good prices, but not the best. But this is nothing new. I mean, this must be like the 10th one of these that they've done.
Yeah, they've been really, really good about this over the last year, and especially just since Plus has come on entirely. Like the deals that they've been putting forward have been really, really competitive with PC stuff. And I've noticed that because last month I built my PC and I got on Steam, like really aggressively on Steam. And I was like, man, this is the best way to buy games. Why isn't everybody embracing this? And Sony's the closest in the console market that I think is to doing it. You know, you'll never get like the dollar deals like you do on Steam, I don't think. But this is the most aggressive I've ever seen a platform holder put their games on sale.
Well, it's pretty awesome. Close to the dollar deals. I mean, there's stuff on here for like $250. There's some great games on here. I mean, Thomas Was Alone is a cross-buy if you're a PS Plus member, $250. Far Cry Blood Dragon for $375 if you're a PS Plus member. I'm going to grab Puppeteer because I've heard such great things about that. It's only $7. Do you guys have any picks? Those are all the PS3 side. The Vita side, I mean, I know, Christian, you're a big fan of the Killzone Mercenary. $9 if you're a PS Plus member, $17.99 if you're not.
Yeah, if you don't have that game and if you're a Plus member, I mean, I bought it at full price and, you know, it's easy to say it's the best first-person shooter on the Vita, and I think I might have, while it's shorter, I think I might have enjoyed the campaign of Mercenaries better than Shadowfall. It's interesting because you play as a mercenary and you work for both the Hellgast and what are the humans called? I always forget what the humans are called because they're so boring. Vectas?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. You play for both sides and it does a decent job of storytelling within the Killzone universe, which I feel like, while I love the game, is usually pretty drab in the storytelling department.
And yeah. I know, Anthony, you're a huge fan of Spelunky.
Oh, dude, if you have a Vita and you have Spelunky, I mean, that is such the desert island setup. I could have a Vita and Spelunky and probably be happy for the rest of my life, in all honesty.
I got to pick that up, too. $375, man. This is great. And I hope this prods Microsoft to do similar stuff and be more aggressive and make these long lists of games, put them on sale, you know, get some excitement.
Well, they've started doing some stuff with gold members for Xbox Live where it's like you get a game every month, just like in PS Plus. So that's good. I mean, it's definitely driving it. And I think what we were afraid of is when these people, like when Sony and when Microsoft started doing like all digital for new consoles, like it was a real fear that they were doing it to price fix and to price lock. So this is actually really, really great. And it shows like a little more awareness of the greater industry than these guys usually show too. You know, it kind of shows that they're like, oh, PCs exist. We should worry about that now.
Right.
Which is interesting.
Yes. We are going to take a break now for a sponsor. We are made possible because of the fine folks at MailChimp. MailChimp.com, easy email newsletters. MailChimp helps you design email newsletters. You can share them on social networks, integrate them with services you already use, and track your results. It's great. If you have any reason to send out mass information to large groups of people, it's like your own personal publishing platform. It's fantastic. They help you customize your sign-up form to match your brand, so you can share it on your website and integrate it into your Facebook page. You can even collect sign-ups from an iPad or a laptop. And importing an existing list into MailChimp is super easy, no matter how it's formatted. You can personalize everything your subscribers see, including sign-up forms and confirmation emails. And guess what, folks? Now, there's never been a better time to try MailChimp. With 2,000 subscribers, and you can send 12,000 emails per month forever. Just visit MailChimp.com/5x5 to learn more. We really appreciate their support of DLC on 5x5. The last little bit of news that I wanted to bring up is something that I think we're all super excited for. The announcement that Awesome Games Done Quick, the guys that do speed runs and stream them live this week, raised over $1 million for charity. How rad is that?
That's so great. That is so great. And it just shows how much people are watching streaming games now.
Yes. It is it's an interesting thing, this phenomenon of speed running and streaming games and people really recognizing that gaming can be a skill that is fun to watch, that done with style, done with done in a way that is not typical, can be just as riveting to watch as, you know, watching a sport or watching, you know, dance or whatever. These guys are working in that medium with the same amount of skill. It's really awesome.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I sort of think of it as, you know, when we all get a game, for the most part, we all play the same game and it's kind of over. And a lot of games don't have the flexibility like a tabletop game has, where you can change your rule set, where you can modify it like that. So it's interesting to see people coming up with things like speed runs or specific condition runs. Have you guys seen Anthony Birch has a Tumblr called No Wrong Way to Play? And he documents weird playthroughs that people do of games. So somebody tried to play through Oblivion the way an NPC would live their life in Oblivion. Like,
oh,
causing
gosh.
No trouble, hanging out in a town, just like living there. And so he documented that. There was another guy who did an all illusion magic run of Skyrim. There was a dude who played the original Zelda without a sword and tried to see how far he could get.
That's
and
awesome.
I remember like this.
I remember hearing about people playing like GTA 3 or later GTAs, whatever, but doing it as a civic-minded, of law-abiding citizen, where you stop at every traffic light and you try to, you know, you try to maintain civility in the city. It's cool to use these systems in ways that they weren't necessarily designed for. Do you guys think that there's a... Go ahead.
That's what got me excited. One, it looks like the phone system is working now. According to chat, it looks like things are working.
Okay.
Two, that's what I originally got excited about achievements for when they were first announced. Because I feel like that's the kind of stuff my little brother and I would do when we were playing games. It was, okay, how far can you get in Super Mario Brothers without, you know, if you jump on a turtle, you die. Like, that was our rule. And then I felt like Geometry Wars did cool things like that with its achievement, where it was, you know, it made... Or Geometry Wars 2, I think, made pacifism a game mode. Whereas in the first one, it was just an achievement. And that was so cool. And now, well, some people are still cool and creative with their achievements. A lot of them are just, you know, like Lego Marvel, great game. But the achievements, a lot of them are, you beat a level. And get creative, do stuff like that that you don't have to do, but lets you experience a game outside of its quote-unquote intended purpose and give people that maybe otherwise wouldn't do it to try playing Skyrim as an NPC and just quirky little fun things that we can do in gaming now. And it's great that people are doing this, but I wish that developers would jump on board a little more than they have.
And, you know, going back to the social thing that we were talking about before, how great would it be if there were, you know, sort of the last Hitman had a mode like this, the kind of horse mode where you assassinate somebody and somebody has to do it the exact same way.
Right.
I would love to see more games have modes like that, where it's okay, well, I went and I did this in this game, or I only killed this specific kind of enemy, or I took this route, which is nearly impossible. Can you do it? And then you could give out sort of social friendship achievements. That would be amazing.
Yeah, that Tony Hawk games had that with you know, a horse and stuff.
Yeah,
where and stuff like that's cool. And it's the thing, like, I feel like because we're still in this renaissance of gaming where people get this cool creative idea and they're like, let's do that. And then they do it. And then people move away from it because they come up with the next cool idea. And people don't spend the time to necessarily perfect or you know, really crystallize these cool ideas and make them as awesome as possible. Because it's like, oh, look at this. What? Now we can, you're always connected. That's the best thing ever. Let's do that. And it's like, we really like this other thing you were doing. Why'd you stop doing that? That was Rumble. That was last gen, right?
All right, we're going to dive back into the phones because Christian says it's working. So if it doesn't work, blame
it's Christian's
Christian.
Fault.
Blame Anthony, our guest.
All right, here we go. A call from 301. Are you there, caller? Hi.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, it's working. What is your
name? It's working. Look at that. It's magic. My name is Matt from Maryland.
Hey, Matt, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful today. Hey, guys, maybe it's just me here. I need a second opinion from you guys. I saw the sales numbers on the Daisy standalone mod that came out. You know, it sold pretty well. I think a lot of people were waiting for it to come out. I told myself I was going to hold off. It's pre-alpha. You know, it's really, really, really early. Don't buy it. Don't buy it. Don't buy it. I personally went ahead. I had a birthday this past weekend. Somebody bought it for me. So I jumped in and started playing it last night. After about 4 or 5 hours, absolutely hated it. Just for the fact that it is a pre-alpha, and it's almost like a skeleton shell of a game. I knew that going into it, and I still sat there last night and played it. I wanted to ask you guys, do I have reason to even be upset for wasting my precious time playing this, or did I know what I was getting into, like the game warned you when you load it up?
Man, early access is such a double-edged sword, right? Because it is. It's like, it helps these people work on their game, finish their game. It gives them access to QA and player testing like nobody is, like small developers have never had before, right? And it lets you check out this kind of cool new thing. But man, I've noticed a lot of people starting to take early access and look at it the same way they look at a finished game. And that's dangerous, right? Because what happens 3 months from now when a lot of people have played DayZ or Rust or something like this and they remember it as being a super broken game and they never open it up again?
To answer your question.
I see people streaming it. Yeah, I see people streaming it. People are tweeting about it. They're posting it on Facebook and stuff. And I wonder, if, you know, for game developers, and you guys are more in the know, obviously, than I am, Do game companies, do they take this stuff with a grain of salt, saying, hey, you knew what you bought when you know, thank you for helping us, but, you know.
So, yeah. I mean, I think to answer your question, you know, can you blame them for them taking your precious time? Maybe taking 30 minutes of it. But after you sat there for another 4.5 hours playing the game, that's your fault.
Because you know what? You're right. But you know, if you guys have seen the game, it's a lot of empty running around. And then when I did find somebody last night, I found myself begging and pleading him for not to kill me because I was so desperate to find something.
Sure, but yeah. I mean, so one, I think we're in a weird world with early access stuff. And I know, Jeff, you and I are kind of on different sides of this coin. But I think it's fair to review these games and critique them in their current state. But I also think it's totally fair for developers to put them out. I mean, DayZ warns you so many times what it is. It's like, I'm going to punch you. Is it okay if I punch you? Well, I guess you can punch me. And then I punch you. And you're like, hey, that hurt. Why'd you punch me? I said I was going to punch you. I mean, this game is incomplete. And the people that are tweeting about it and streaming it, most, like 80% of what I see, people are having fun with it and having fun being like, this is so silly, this is so dumb, oh my gosh, I just played for 2 hours and I saw nothing, this game is broken, I can't believe, this is crazy, this is so much fun. And like, why is it weird to say that a game can come out like that and people are having fun like that? And you know, some people argue, well, that's dumb, that's stupid. But then on this show, we were just saying how it's cool how people sit around for 10 hours and try to be an NPC in a Morrowind game.
Matt, is that you may, would this game eventually comes out, you may end up not liking it even then. You know, it may just not be your cup of tea.
Right.
I have this feeling that if you don't like DayZ now, then 6 months from now, when they iron out all the bugs, it's still going to be the same game. You know, you probably still will not like it 6 months from now. If you don't like running around for 90 minutes to get a backpack and then have somebody shoot you in the face for it, like, that's always going to be DayZ. That happens to me every time I played DayZ, by the way, which is why I don't like it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call, buddy. We really appreciate it.
Jeff, may I just ask you one more quick question, sir?
Sure. Go ahead.
Hey, Jeff, I have been trying to get my wife into gaming. I've had some luck with video games, trying to get her into, like, the simple Spelunky or stuff like that. Is there, just quickly, not to take more time, is there like a simple tabletop game that you can recommend that's great for maybe like her and I to sit around and play maybe a half hour, maybe an hour long? I know it's totally, you know, different topic than my last question.
No, that's great. I appreciate the call and I appreciate the question. This is the question I get the most about board gaming. I've answered this question on Twitter hundreds of times, and I love it. I love that people want to get into it. There's so many kinds of games. There are so many. There's a board game for every personality, and everybody wants those two player experiences that they can have with their wives. The easiest, quickest, simplest.
I want my childhood Heroes Quest back.
Well, there you go. It's actually being re-released, but the easiest, quickest, simplest answer is Ticket to Ride. Ticket to Ride has been my go-to, introduce new people to board gaming. Oh my gosh, this is awesome. It's so simple. I could teach it to you in about 4 seconds. It's brilliant, wonderful, deep, and really accessible to people that don't like, you know, orcs and goblins and spaceships. But there's also a million other two-player games that are great. I always recommend Battle Line, which is a really fun card game, and it's super cheap. And if you are into, you know, sword and sorcery kinds of stuff, Summoner Wars is great, simple to learn, deep, fun. We really appreciate the call. Thank you very much. I wish you luck with that. The other thing that you have to keep in mind is if people don't like something, they're not going to like it. There's nothing that you have to be patient and bring people in and be respectful of the fact that maybe it's just not their thing, but there are certainly tons of great board gaming experiences that are two player, that are easy, that are quick, that are simple.
Can I add in one?
Oh, that's please.
Because my fiance is not big into board games either. And I found that one of the things that's a big roadblock is when somebody's new to something and they don't understand the shorthand of it, the lose condition, the fact that they could go in and lose and not understand why they lost is very frustrating for people. So to do something that's not just a short time investment, but also cooperative, I had a lot of luck with Forbidden Island because you're working together and you can help each other out and there's a lot of communication. And she really loved that one. So I think anything that's cooperative is generally helpful to getting people into things.
Yeah, and there are cooperative games have really exploded in the last few years, and there's a whole bunch of them. Forbidden Island and Forbidden Desert are sort of companion pieces. They're great. They're made for to be accessible to even younger ages, but they're super fun for people that are our age and older. That's made by the same guy who made Pandemic, which is sort of the prototypical awesome co-op game. So yeah, I totally second that recommendation as well. Those are great. Let's go to another call because this is working now and I'm super excited about it. Are you there, caller? Hi.
Hi there. Look, it's Adam from Australia. I'm so sorry it didn't work out before.
That's okay. What's up, Adam? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I just wanted to ask what you in particular thought about the revelation Pebble Steel at CES last week. I thought it looked pretty cool, but I also kind of want to wait and see what Apple might do with the watch.
I think you might have to repeat. What was it that he asked?
I think he's asking about the new Pebble watch. Pebble released the new Steel showed off the new Steel at CES.
Thanks, Adam.
And the desire to jump into wearables, which is a horrible name for a product category.
Lame. It sounds like something I don't want to do, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Don't forget your wearables, bro. Now, if it were Danimals, I'm on board. That's a delicious snack. For me, if I had enough, or to answer your question, I think it depends on your disposable income. If you have enough disposable income and you are interested in this, then dive in. You know, people have been wearing Pebbles for, you know, a year now or whatever, and they do what they say they do. They're missing some features that people want, but people seem overall pretty satisfied with them. If you don't have tons of disposable income, and I know in Australia games are like $400 and one great white shark fin, you know, maybe wait for Apple to enter the market, because people were waiting for Samsung to enter the market in the Galaxy Gear. I don't know if that's out worldwide, but it's here in the U.S., has been a flop critically and commercially. And so I think, you know, I think it's right to be a little gun shy with this stuff. And historically, recent trends, Apple has a great track record. So if you don't have tons of money to burn, maybe wait and see and then compare your options. And maybe Pebble is still the best way to go. But if not, you know, what's the rush? Do you need it is always the question to ask yourself, even though the answer can often be no, and you can still buy it, right? I mean, do I need a PS4? No. Did I buy it? You're dang right I did. But I think that's
I'm just waiting until they make a wearable that isn't dumb looking.
Yeah.
Well, that's like how big it is supposed to be.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be, but like when you actually put it on, it's huge. It's huge, and the e-ink looks weird. I don't know. It's hard to get me to wear a watch anymore anyway, just because I have a mobile phone in my pocket that tells time. It's weird. I don't see anything compelling in terms of functionality or in terms of style that makes me want to put one of these things on. CES last week was just dudes walking around in Google Glass, and I just wanted to shake them.
I wanted to shake them so hard.
I don't know. I feel like... Yes, I agree with you that fashion is going to be key for this, and you have to not feel like a tool when you're wearing one of these tools.
Fashion. Sorry, I got
nothing. And it's going to have to. They're going to have to crack that nut somehow. And I think we all can agree that the people most likely to do that are Apple. They seem to be hiring all these people from the fashion world right now, and it'll be interesting to see if and when they get into this market what it looks like, but. I did have a Pebble when I was doing Always On. I had a Pebble watch for a prolonged period of time to test it out. And I have to say, getting notifications on my wrist was pretty cool. I'm one of those people that misses half the freaking texts I get because I don't feel it in my pocket or I don't hear it or I get like a phantom vibration on my leg that's like, oh, my phone isn't even in my pocket. Why did my leg vibrate? So I can't wait for the phantom wrist vibration that I'll start feeling. But but it was great not missing those things because it was right there on my wrist and I could just check it. Is that enough for me to wear something goofy all the time? No. I mean, I don't wear the Pebble now. So I don't know. I think you're absolutely right, Anthony, that it's just, it needs to be cool and work. And the biggest hurdle for me, honestly, is charging it. I don't want to have to worry about charging it. You know, I don't want to have my wristwatch run out of batteries. It's bad enough when your phone runs out of batteries. You know, your wristwatch, you want to be able to just check easily and quickly. And I don't want to ever have to worry about, oh, did I plug in my watch last night?
So that it's like the first time you're on a phone and your Kindle runs out of battery. And you're like, I have every book I've ever wanted to read. And you feel like a 2012 version or 2014 version of Burgess Meredith in like the Twilight Zone. Yes. You're like, there was time now. There was so much time.
It's absolutely true. Although my whole life is changed now that I can actually keep my Kindle on during takeoff and landing of a flight. I'm like, thank you so much. I can keep reading. And while I used to be jealous of the people with magazines, because I'd be like, I'll just wait until we take off so I can open my Kindle again.
You have to read the in-flight magazine. You're like, I wonder what the CEO of Delta has to say this month.
Exactly.
Well, I think all we right. can all agree that my story of the week was the actual story of the week. What else do we have?
That's so not true. In fact, yours might not even be a story, let alone the story of the week. It may not even hit that bar. I want to get to another call, but first, I know I want to bring this up. We have Anthony Carboni here. We got to talk about Nidhogg, which I think released like an hour ago.
Yeah. I was just reloading Steam app this morning, all morning. Search for Nidhogg. Finally,
so
came
tell
out
us what is Nidhogg and why should we be excited?
Nidhogg is this amazing game that Mark Essen released as a prototype about 3 years ago, and it's a two-player fencing game, which, I mean, just by the log line doesn't sound incredibly great, but it's one of the most balanced and interesting two-player competitive games I have ever played in my life. It's a two-button game, basically, you've got your sword, and it's almost like the parrying system in complex fighting games, right? You can attack high and low and mid, but you have to parry it in the same way. And what you're trying to do is get by the other guy and run across to the other side of this multi-screen arena that you're both in. And it's cool. You can like throw your sword at somebody and then you have to like retrieve it or die and come back with another sword. It's crazy. It's so much fun. It's so hard to describe, but it's one of the best like tactical versus games I've played in years.
It's even harder to describe when you look at it because it's like this assault on your eyeballs of craziness. I mean, the graphical style of all his games are pretty crazy and cool and different. I mean, it's that, you know, that retro style, but it's even more insane because there's the backgrounds are kind of flashing and changing and, you know, there's a lot of movement and craziness, but the animation of the actual sword fighting is fascinating to watch as well.
It's like a 4-bit Commodore version of a Jordan Mechner game.
Really. Right. Exactly.
Like, well, it reminds me of the animation.
One of my favorite games when I was a kid, which only existed in my world in one particular pizza parlor that was in one particular location that we almost never got to. So it was so special when I got to play this game, and that was Karate Champ.
Yeah.
Because Karate Champ, to anybody that remembers it, it was, you know, two players, two karate experts facing off against one another, and two joysticks that had very specific kind of movements associated and would create different kicks and punches. And there was really no explanation as to how it all worked, at least to my little, you know, 8-year-old brain. But it was just this magical, like, I can do anything I want. I'm a karate champ and I have to vanquish this one foe standing between me and the next screen.
Yeah. It feels a lot like I had the NES version of that, which was a majorly disappointing port, but because it was like, you would push a button, you would just slow kind of kick, and you're like, well, I guess I lost, because it was kind of like there was something like impossible to figure out. There was something so opaque about Karate Champ. But what's great about Nidhogg is you can jump in, and it almost has that sort of variable difficulty. You know, there are a bunch of proverbs about sword fighting, which are like, the greatest swordsman in the world really only has anything to fear from the worst swordsman in the world, right? Because that is the person who doesn't know any strategy, who doesn't know anything. And Nidhogg is really very much that put into practice in a game, because once you learn how to do everything in Nidhogg,
doesn't that quote make you just not want to practice then?
Yeah. Like, it makes me want to be the button mashiest guy in the arcade at all times forever.
You're a master swordsman. What did you do? Nothing, actually. I've never held a sword before. Oh my gosh.
Cool. Cause I'm bleeding out. Awesome. But this is great because we have it actually, it was on the Winnetron, which is like this indie arcade machine with like multiple games, and a lot of like big indie guys put games on the Winnetron before they had big retail successes. And there's like a beta version of Nidhogg from 3 years ago on it, and we play it nonstop, and it's fun to just watch people getting into it. And it has that thing sort of like a Smash Brothers or a Dead or Alive because of that accessibility, where it is always surprising who's going to win, who's going to pull out a victory. And that makes it fun, because the guy who's the better player is usually going to win, but there is always that variable, right? Like that toss-up where it's like, oh, whoa, I did not expect that to happen, and now I've died a million times.
How does it control? Do you really feel like you do the move that you want to do in the right moment? I mean, does it really feel like level of precision with the fencing?
Yeah, absolutely, because it's basically a high-low, right? And it's very visual in terms of whether you're attacking high or low. So unlike something like a Dead or Alive or a Virtua Fighter, where you really have to know the move set to be able to parry and to be able to see what's happening, here it's the iconography is very easy. So if you want to attack high, you tap up and you're immediately about to attack high on your next attack. But the other person can see that instantly too. So it's very easy to read. It's very fast paced because of how simple it is.
And it's just a series of like over and over, you're like fight each other, next screen, fight each other, next screen, fight each, like that. That's how it feels.
Yeah, exactly. So, and the deal is like, you're trying to run to the other guy's side of the arena, and it's multi screens, and you can chase each other. And there's like a little bit of platforming and run and jump. So it's
like a tug of war meets a fighting game.
Yeah, there's like this freeze tag kind of playground element to it too, where you're just running, chasing, tagging, fighting. It's a lot of fun.
Cool. It looks like somebody by the name of Garnet L in the chat room suggested that maybe the solution to the wearables idea is kind of like the thing that quarterbacks wear, where it flips up on your wrist. It's like almost covers your entire forearm. And I say that still would look dorky, but I would love to hear what you guys think.
I think I don't know if he was saying it's going to be that big. I mean, to me, what I pictured is something like it's this weird thing, right, where they're trying to force new technology on an old product, like a wristwatch. And I don't know. I think that idea of being a totally new thing that you do wear could be cool. I don't think it needs to be as big as, you know, Tony Romo's throw an interception play call sheet that he wears on his wrist every game. doesn't need to be as, you know, like Colin's sideways hat that he wears in post game interviews either, but like something new. Why does it need to be a wristwatch? Like there could be a cool, yeah. I think like Nike Fuel Bands look cool, quote unquote. You know, I know it's not a full smartwatch, but at least it is its own thing fashion wise.
I like the idea of Google Glass. I like the idea of the unobtrusiveness because I think it also, you know, as opposed to even a wearable that looks like a watch or is on your wrist, there are social issues that have come up with sort of having this always on lifestyle, right? And the idea of being able to get the information that you need without having to break eye contact with the person that you're talking to is kind of interesting to me. But once again, it's like it has to look like a normal pair of glasses to me. It can't be this new future Google thing.
Is it better or worse not to break eye contact? Because I feel like, you know... Are you listening to me? Are you just reading your email?
Everyone has, and I apologize for people I'm about to offend. It's like you're talking to everyone, but everyone has a lazy eye, so you don't quite know where they're looking. You're like, I'm over here. I'm so sorry, people with lazy eyes. But this is audio, so I don't know who you are. Deal with it.
It's like every girlfriend's worst nightmare. It's like, are you listening to me? Wait a minute, You're playing Dark Souls, aren't you? No, I'm not. I'm looking right in the eye.
I just want to go to a campfire with you. Oh, crap.
Just wait until they have augmented reality games within Google Glass and you're out like couch shopping, but also you're on a dungeon run. I feel like that's the best time to be alive.
Oh my God, that's what I'm looking forward to. I read this article a while back. I can't remember where it was, but it was about people who are using Google Glass to sort of take geocaching to the next level where they're literally mapping using, geographic tagging. They're mapping like every outlet that is, you know, like electrical outlet that is in the world. So that if you ever need to plug your phone in, all you have to do to go to Google Glass and go, where's the closest electrical outlet? Or, you know, where is it? Literally this granular level of mapping to the point where, yeah, all that can be loaded into a video game and create this incredible adventure across your neighborhood or what city or whatever that involves you having to interact with real things and go to real places and hear fictional things that tie into real stuff. I mean, come on, that's amazing.
Yeah, Google had Ingress, which was their sort of augmented reality game for Nexus phones. It was supposed to run on like flagship Android devices where you're solving puzzles and trying to look for hidden things around you in your own city. And it's been tried a couple times, and I'm just waiting for the technology to catch up because I love that idea of just this live scavenger hunter, this live version of almost Ready Player One, you know, without having to dip all the way into VR goggles. But being able to, like we said, those social achievements that we would love to do, it would be kind of cool to do something with friends where it's like, well, I made it through this park in this route in this much time, and I set up obstacles for you. Can you beat it?
Super cool.
Like, that would be rad.
All right, we're going to take another call, but first we have to thank our sponsor, New Relic. New Relic, if you've got a web or mobile application, you need New Relic. It's the developer's best friend because it's easy to use, and it's an analytics dashboard that gives you, as a developer, powerful code-level visibility into the real-time performance of your applications. This means you can spot bugs, see bottlenecks, and fix problems fast before they ever affect your user. Thanks to New Relic, you no longer have to ship an app to production and then helplessly wait around hoping for the best until negative app reviews and tweets start to pour in. New Relic empowers software engineers by showing them what's working and what isn't all in real time. The way it works is really straightforward. New Relic gives developers a lightweight agent that you unpackage into your production level apps. That agent sits quietly and securely in the background, gathering real-time metrics across geographies, devices, platforms, all the way down to the end user level, and then displays all that data in real-time graphs so that coders have total visibility into the performance of their web and mobile applications. Do yourself a favor and check this company out. Make sure you go to newrelic.com and you will get a 30-day extended free pro trial. They build better performing apps. You can build more. I can't speak English all of a sudden, but you can build better performing apps, get deeper insights, and spot bottlenecks quickly and improve performance with New Relic. And we thank New Relic for sponsoring DLC. They're making the show possible, and we appreciate it. All right, dudes, let's take another call because this is working so well. Call from 607. Are you there, caller? Hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Doing great. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, my name is Jeff. I'm from Rochester, New York. I actually got in last week, too, so twice in a row.
Awesome. What do you want to talk about this week?
So I was actually wanting to keep going on the early access stuff you guys were talking about. I'm curious maybe if some people are kind of turned off by early access because maybe they don't understand the game development process very well. As a software engineer myself, I know that, you know, a system usually doesn't come together fully until, you know, a week before it goes out the door. So, you know, it's understandable that there's typically a lot of systems that aren't done in early access games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sick burn to that other caller. Do you hear that? You got taken to school. Maybe if you knew, I'm just kidding.
Eat it.
Well, I mean, that's the deal with early access is you're getting in and you're seeing something that isn't done. I'm on record as saying that's not really the way I want to digest my video games. I really believe there's never a second chance to make a first impression, and I want to experience the game in all its glory the best way I can. And I'm that way with all my media. You know, I don't want things spoiled. I want to have the best experience I can. I want to see the movie on the best screen. I want to play the game, you know, with the best controller input. I want to preserve the top of the line experience for myself. And that includes not seeing behind the curtain to see all the development process. It's just not exciting to me. Now, the other side of that coin is people argue that sometimes there's this window in the development process where you get a better version of the game and then they sort of step back from that. So some people love the fact that you get these different iterations happening, and sometimes you can have a period of a few months where you're actually playing a game that's better than the one that they released because there's interesting systems that the developers don't really love, but you might like more. So you're sort of exposed to that. For me, it's not really what I want.
Doesn't that just set you up for more disappointment, though, when they rip that out if you really love it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It doesn't change the fact that you got to play it and have fun with it, though.
That's true. You know, there are some games that I'm really loving on early access, and there are some games that I'm not. And what I've found is if I get in there and I feel like it's really rough, I set it aside. What was it? It was, gosh, I can't remember, but there's sort of like a space theme roguelike dungeon run that's in early access right now that I played.
Starbound?
Not Starbound. I can't remember it. If I can remember it or if I can find it, I'll let you guys know what it is. But the point is that it was really, really rough. And I played it for a day or two and I was like, you know what? This is not working for me, but I like where they're going. I feel like this is going to go somewhere, so I'm going to put this aside for a few months. The flip side of that is Nuclear Throne, where I play it almost every day, and every week when they add these incremental updates, I feel like it's only getting better and better. And I guess the thing is, like, if you love the idea of a game, you can always set it aside. You know, you've bought it, and there's some comfort in knowing that a year from now it'll be finished. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like a Kickstarter where at least you know the game exists, right? Like, at least you know it's not going to default and there's a game out there for you to have and own.
This is my answer, and I'm going to be a hypocrite of what I said earlier by making a declarative statement. This will always be my answer for this. Options are good. If you don't like it, don't play it. If you do like it, enjoy it. I mean, this isn't like I'm not, you know, forcing little kids to do cocaine or heroin. This is like, hey, you want to spend some of your hard-earned money to get into this game that's not finished? Go ahead and do it. Well, yeah, but it's more about it. blah, blah, blah. Who cares? Your friends like what? It. You don't. My friends like Transformers. I didn't like any of the Transformers movies. We're still friends, except for Brad. I hate him.
Yeah, Brad, he has terrible taste. But I think it's more complicated than that, too, though, because, you know, as the previous caller pointed out early on, that these games do, there's an effect to the sort of accepted opinion of what these games are. And if they're putting these games out, they're charging money for them, a bunch of people are downloading them and playing them. And there's this massive, I'm not saying that's happening with this particular game, but if there's a situation in which there's this massive negative backlash, it can hurt what may end up being a really great game simply because it's not done. And so just because I don't like it or, you know, all these options, I don't know if we can simplify it that much and just say, well, it's options are better. It might not actually be better for the end product.
Well, I think publishers, you know, I hate to be a free economy, blah, 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 economy 101. The market will bear that out. People are jumping into this. Maybe that shouldn't. And next time they make a game, they'll be like, well, that was really stupid for us to release it in early access because everybody thinks, you know, puppies and dragonflies is about sword fighting, when in fact, that was just a placeholder for more puppies. People will realize their mistakes and move on. If it's a bad thing for them to do, they'll stop doing it. But I think to decry the whole idea of early access because it might ruin an eventual end user's experience of the game or taint what this game could be and hurt an otherwise brilliant game, who cares? If there's a brilliant game in there, someone else will make it eventually and they won't do early access for it next time. I just fail to see how like having this stuff out there is bad. I don't, Jeff.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, I think it's new.
You, but I don't get it.
I think it's new, and I think it's something where everybody has to get a handle on what their position in an ecosystem with early access or fundraising or anything like that is, right? So you have to be confident enough about your game and about yourself as a developer that you can go into early access with something playable enough so that the word of mouth doesn't hurt. And then on the press side and on the critic side, there has to be a level of responsibility in kind of keeping back a level of enthusiasm or keeping back a level of vitriol against a game that's in early access as well, right?
Yeah.
And then it's also about, as a developer and as the press, educating this audience that's new to early access, right? Like, one of the things I like about Vlambeer when they're doing Nuclear Throne is they're very, very communicative on their blog, right? They're very like, here's what's going on. Here's the plan for this. If you don't like this, I want you to know that it's going to be like this in a month. And I think that's how you manage those expectations. I think there are a lot of games that are on early access where kind of like DayZ a little bit, where they throw it up and they're like, this is what it's like, and we're going to change some stuff and you're going to lose your saves. And that's all you ever hear from them, you know? And yeah, that kind of is what makes people think, I bought a broken game. I don't like early access. So I think there's a responsibility on kind of like all three points on this triangle here to kind of manage each other's expectations and educate each other.
Well said. I know, Christian, you wanted to talk about, you actually brought this up earlier with Tony Hawk. You want to talk about skateboarding games?
Oh, man. Am I the only one excited by Ollie Ollie coming? It comes out, one, it's for the Vita. Yes, please. Two, holy crap. This game looks amazing. I haven't had a chance to go hands-on with it. I think, you know, some people in the biz have. I have not. Wow. I'm so excited for this game.
I'm so ready. I'm so ready for this game.
Have you played it, Anthony, or just seen it?
I've just seen it. I'm ready. It's just beautiful. An endless runner plus skateboarding game just sounds like the best thing to me. The best
thing. Yeah, and it's really gorgeous, simple graphics, if that makes sense. Like, the animation looks smooth for what it is, but it's not trying to be, you know, something amazing, but like it's vibrant. There are colors, trick multipliers, and it's like, it looks to me like cannonball, however you say that.
Cannonball. Yeah,
cannonball, there it is. It looks a lot like that, but with brighter colors, and you're doing tricks, and then when you crash you face plant and tumble for half a mile before you face plant. I'm really, really jazzed for this game, and it just kind of brings me back to how jazzed I was for the first Tony Hawk, or my favorite Tony Hawk was Tony Hawk Pro Skater 2 for the Game Boy Advance. I guess I've always been a sucker for
Game Boy Advance. It was so busted.
No way. The Game Boy Advance one was busted. It was beautiful. Isometric top-down display. It was flawless. It was so good.
Girl, you crazy.
I feel like you're wearing the rose-tinted glasses here, man. You've got some nostalgia vibes going on. But this I'll tell you what. Oli Oli looks to me like the way you're remembering that game, for sure.
Okay, it looks like the way you remember that game. I love that.
I don't go back and play it, though I did find it when I was cleaning out my garage in preparation of a move later this month. I did not fire up the original Tony Hawk for Game Boy Advance and relive the memories. But yes, Oli Oli is giving me that flutter, warm and fuzzy feeling in my heart. I'm really jazzed for this game, and I think skateboarding games got so complicated, and remember when Tony Hawk went like story and there was like a plot to it? And it's just, what are you
underground
doing?
I will agree with you this far, Christian. Tony Hawk Pro Skater 2 is the best skateboarding game ever made, just not on that platform. It was on the PC, which is how I played it. It was spectacular and awesome.
Do you remember unlocking Spider-Man and just being like, well, this is everything I've ever dreamed in life?
Exactly.
This is exactly the way I picture the world in my head. Thank you.
So true. We talk about how, you know, Activision sort of killed off the music game, rhythm game genre by over iterating, and they seem to sort of be doing that with Call of Duty. But the first game series that they did that with is skateboarding genre, and it was really sad because I loved those games. And it was that feature creep kind of like, how we got to one up ourselves, how do we make this game more than what it is? And it's like, no, you just getting further and further away from what makes it wonderful, which is just, you know, ollieing over a house. You know, that's what I want to do.
How awful was the HD remake? Did either of you waste $15 on that? It was, I don't know what was wrong. Like, the physics felt off. All you needed to do was make it prettier, and they didn't even give you a bunch of levels. The soundtrack wasn't the same. It was the worst example of an HD remake that I can think of right this second.
Yeah, it was not great. I didn't like the handful of levels that they picked. I didn't like that they were trying to release them as like DLC packs. And I don't know if it was that the controls felt off because they messed them up, or if it was just that controls and camera controls and the way we expect things to work now is so much better. Like, playing that just made me want to play a new Tony Hawk where we have the understanding of control response and camera control that we have now. And I kind of miss like all these extreme sports games that came out early part of last decade, because they were great, man. I don't want to go out and skateboard, but I'll play a skateboarding game for like 6 hours.
Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah, for sure. And snowboarding is the same way. And there was this amazing the original Xbox had this amazing wakeboarding game that I can't remember the name of, but I played the living crap out of that game. Oh God, what was it? Wakeboarding Extreme or Wakeboarding Unleashed or something like that?
Yes, it was Unleashed. It was Sean Murray's Wakeboarding Unleashed.
Oh, I loved that game with my whole heart. It was so much fun. So if you guys could decide whether we get a new awesome skateboarding game or like a new awesome Tony Hawk or a new awesome SSX, what would you choose?
Does the new Tony Hawk come with that giant plastic skateboard?
No, it does not.
Okay.
Tony Hawk.
Tony Hawk.
Yeah, the Tony Hawk of my dreams is better than the SSX of my dreams.
Oh,
I feel
so
like the SSX that came out last year was phenomenal.
It was that
I
last
was really
year.
Into it was, longer it. Ago it was than 2 years. End of 2011. I don't know. It was recent.
Yeah, but yeah, I will. I want SSX does it way more than Tony Hawk. The thrill of going down a mountain at high speed is much more than the thrill of, you know, being awesome in somebody's backyard for me.
The only thing that SSX was missing was direct head to head racing down the mountain, because they did sort of drive. They did that almost Need for Speed thing where you were racing against ghost runs.
Right.
But I wanted like that live split screen.
For sure. What's this?
Yeah, bring back extreme sports games, man.
Yeah, more aggressive inline. More. I need more Arlo Eisenberg in my life.
Yeah, more Razor Scooter. You remember that Razor Scooter game for the PlayStation? Bring that back.
Was it on Spike or one of those TV shows? They had like, you know, world record attempt, and it was a dude doing a double backflip on a Razor scooter, And I think they cut to it live, and he was at Camp Woodward in Pennsylvania. Shout out to the OG Woodward. And he never landed it.
Oh, God.
And you know he had to have landed it like 10 times in rehearsal. And we're live.
The problem with that is that I picture him like in a cornflower blue tie and like a shirt and some khakis, razor scootering on the way to his next meeting and just trying to do a double backflip on the way. Like, that's what I picture a razor scooter. That's the dude.
Do kids still use razor scooters, or are they a thing of the past?
Do .com execs still use razor scooters?
Not to throw anybody under the bus, but there we got a couple of them here at DDN. I'm always like shaking my head, like, no, man, don't get on that razor scooter. I'm thinking about buying them all Heelys.
Yes. Dude, have you tried a Heely? It ain't easy, man. Heelys are not easy.
Maybe that's the extreme sports game we need. We need Heely Extreme Racing. Somebody there make that go. Happen.
Heely Extreme Racing.
Do you have a pair of size 12 Heelys, Jeff?
They sell them, and we bought them for TRS years ago, and all checked them out. You can watch that video. It's embarrassing because we almost all die. But I love the idea of a Heely racing game where you're going just slightly faster than you can walk. You know,
but only on a decline. The parts of the racing course that are like on an incline, you just have to walk on your toes real slow.
Yeah, I love it. All right, let's go to a caller. Actually, this might be our friend from earlier. It's still the 949. Hello, caller. Are you there?
Yeah, hey, it's Aaron from Laguna Hills.
Oh, Aaron, what's up? How you doing?
Hey, good. I completely play a Heely game. That'd be amazing. I'm not sure if this is talked about at all, but Telltale Games. I've been a big fan of the Telltale game series. I know Spicer, you've been a fan of the Walking Dead games, in particular. And, yeah, Gary.
Yes. Yes, I'm a big fan of them. Was there a question?
Yeah, I was trying to get to, I couldn't hear anybody, so I wasn't sure if anybody was there. I know there's a lot of licensed properties that have been kind of coming up. Like, there's going to be a Game of Thrones Telltale games. There's going to be a Borderlands Telltale kind of game series. I'm curious if you had to choose between, if you had like a licensed game, would you like to see, like, is there anyone from like Telltale in particular that you like to see like happen, or if you had a choice, would
that's a great question.
Like, yeah,
that's a really great question. Like, thanks a lot. Is there an established IP that you think would particularly work well as a Telltale style adventure game, guys?
Man, you know, I would almost say
Showgirls.
Yeah, you read my mind. With those quick time events where you have to do like the face hand motion in front of you.
There you go.
A walk off. Yeah. No, I was thinking I like the idea of that of the new Alien game that's coming out, but I also like the idea of a more adventure game style Alien game.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that would actually work well. I love the idea of it being straight, well, I guess Walking Dead is horror, but I was going to say straight up horror game. It's interesting. I think that comic book properties tend to lend themselves really well just because their art style translates effectively over to that Telltale style.
I also think the more powerful a superhero is, the better it is to remove direct one-to-one combat. Like, that's why we've never had a good Superman game.
Yeah, very astute point. A Superman adventure game would be super interesting. You could have the whole Clark Kent side would be really fascinating gameplay wise. Cause that's, you know, you're chasing down stories and you're having to, you know, make sure nobody sees you get into the outfit. That'd be fun.
Kanata, here you go. What makes the Telltale games for me, like The Wolf Among Us and now The Walking Dead and then The Wolf Among Us, it are these gray areas, these horrible, decisions that you have to get into. And for me, that game should be you play as a guy I like to call Vic Mackey.
Oh, my God.
You are the shield.
Yeah.
And you have to deal with all of the gray area that he... Because I feel like that show, if you haven't watched it, watch it. It's amazing.
Best show ever.
But, you know, he starts off as a somewhat likable character, or like Breaking Bad is a more modern example. But the decisions you make, and the further you go into that rabbit hole, how do you come out of it? How do you make, out of five bad decisions, which one do you pick? But there's justification for all of them. That's what I think Telltale's been doing so well recently versus, you know, Sam and Max, which were great, but didn't have the sales success that they're having now. And so I'd love to see a game like that.
Yeah, that would be amazing. That's a good point with the ethical decisions. I think you're right. The compelling thing in an adventure game is not when there's a right or wrong decision. It's when there are a million just messed up decisions. Like, well, this is the one that I feel like right now. And what does that mean?
Exactly. That's what I love about, those are my favorite kinds of role-playing experiences. And I think Telltale games are very much role-playing games, because I am assuming that situation and trying to decide, oh my God, how would I decide? What would I do in this? And I feel like the Dragon Age game is really good about that, of creating not a good side and a bad side, not a hero and a villain, but a whole range of equally bad decisions or equally good decisions, or decisions that are difficult to make no matter what and have good and bad consequences for different people. I mean, the decision in the Walking Dead episodes of who to feed is more compelling to me than any decision I ever made in any Mass Effect game.
Yeah. Sorry, dude, I was just going to say that, because you're just, you hand a granola bar to a little girl, and everybody gives you this glare like, where'd you get that granola bar? Right. Like, oh, what did I do?
Yeah. And that's
how you feel guilty over a granola bar.
That's how you create drama. That's how you create, and being able to have an interactive moment that invests me in those characters that much. And that's why I feel like these games where you can either have the dark side or the light side, it's so much less interesting to me than really thinking about what would I do and deciding, sort of defining who I am by those decisions, rather than do I want to be a hero or a villain?
Yeah, sometimes I feel like I could play these modern Telltale games by going with the not saying anything option for the whole game, because I'm like, I didn't respond. Oh man. And that's so much more gut-wrenching than like Infamous. I'm so jazzed for Infamous Second Son. I love the Infamous games, but it's, yeah, am I going to be the blue good guy or the red bad guy? And you know, that's not the hotness that the Telltale games give you.
Yeah. A person in the chat room whose name I can't pronounce, B12N11 Woot, said you're spot on, Spicer, which I already disagree with, but said that the weaker of the Telltale games, like Back to the Future, lack that. That's what makes the best of the Telltale games better, is that in Back to the Future, you're never really a sort of Shades of Grey Marty McFly. I didn't play the Back to the Future, though, so I can't have any personal input.
I played the first episode. It was a very competent point-and-click adventure with cute humor, but it was just that to me. I don't know, Anthony, if you disagree.
No, I was completely going to agree. I think all their stuff, their Sam and Max stuff, their Back to the Future, their Strong Bad, it was all fine. They were doing just fine. And I think it was when they made that choice to be like, nah, let's make an adventure game where we get rid of all the silly, like the sillier puzzles, and make it so there isn't a right choice. When they decided that they were going to go with something that was a little more adult and something that never gave you anything clear cut, is when they became who they were. Because before that, I think they had one of the spottiest records of any gaming company ever. Because they also made that Jurassic Park game. They made some bad games, y'all.
Well, that Jurassic Park was post Walking Dead, right? And I think that was them like, we did this great game. Let's get another license. This game's going to be great. And it was not great.
Oh, that's right.
I'm not sure it was post. Was it post? Was it? I don't know. All right, I'm going to talk about a little bit of tabletop stuff. I know, Anthony, you're a fan of the board games.
I'm just getting into them, yeah.
Say again?
I'm just getting serious about them, yeah.
I love it. Well, I'd love to hear what you've been playing, or anything that you like recently. Any particular standouts?
We just started a game night at work, and it's not anything super surprising yet because we haven't gone real deep. We're all kind of neophytes, but I did pick up Gauntlet of Fools after you mentioned it last week.
Nice.
That was a lot of fun. I feel like we haven't gotten the hang of the boasting quite yet, or we just haven't gotten some wildly divergent characters on a hand yet.
Yeah.
To make it make sense.
I noticed it took a few playthroughs to sort of get why you got to really prevent that guy from getting that combination or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
It takes a little bit getting used to. One of my goals go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, other than that, we've been playing Story War. We had Brad O'Farrell here to show us Story War.
Oh, fun.
Game that he did on Kickstarter. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And we played some Munchkin and some Small World.
Oh, yeah, Munchkin was sort of my gateway game way back in the day, which is great. I love those games. They tend to turn into 5-6 hour marathon sessions when we play with my group. That's just because we're arguing constantly. That's a game where the rule set is purposefully vague so that you end up having to yell at each other about things that you can
There was one dude at the table who was just clutching the rule. He's like, I don't think you can. I don't know if you can. I was like, it doesn't say anything about it, dude.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's one of those games.
Yeah. The Story War I played at PAX Australia last year, and that was really fun. It's a really creative game. Really interesting.
Another one where if you're somebody who needs like a very strict rule set to get yourself through, it's not like that. It's basically it's storytelling for a judge, which I really love.
Yeah. I mean, it really is dependent on the group of people you're playing with. So if you have people that really, you know, are kind of introverted and not interested in making up stories, it won't necessarily work as well. But it's fun, you know, weaving a yarn, having to fit these things that are on cards into that story. And then the guy goes, you know what? I think you win or you win. So it's kind of fun. Very apples to apples-esque, or Cards Against Humanity without the smut. But one of my goals with this show is to sort of give people a roadmap if they want to get into board games. As I said, people are constantly asking me for suggestions. So I'm going to go back to a classic that I really don't think I've mentioned on many other shows, but it's probably in my top five board game experiences. I love this game with my whole heart, and that is Power Grid by Friedman Fries. It's not a very new game. It came out in the early 2000s, but it is phenomenal, spectacular game, and it has tons of expansions. Basically, the idea is that you and the other players are competing to create the most profitable power grids. You're building power plants, and you're investing in infrastructure and buying, you know, a range of different kinds of power plants, whether they be dirty, fossil fuel burning, or clean energy, and they have certain benefits negative aspects to them based on what kinds of power that they use. And you can sort of try to corner the market on coal or oil or wind energy or even nuclear. And you're placing your power grids across a map, and there's tons of different maps you can get for the game. United States and pretty much any country at this point has been created in Power Grid. It begins with a phase where you're auctioning off kinds of power grids, and then you're manipulating the markets in certain ways, and then you're purchasing power plants, and then those power plants are generating money for you. So there's all these different phases that work together. There's tons of decisions to be made all the time. This is sort of the classic, what they call a Euro game, where you're manipulating systems to get yourself more points, victory points.
I was going to say, is this a German game?
It is, yeah. Friedman Fries is a pretty he's a German developer that has done a lot of games, and almost all of them are interesting, at least, or great. Or the best ones are great, as is this one.
I love German games because German games are these wonderfully entertaining games. But when you hear the basis of them, where, like, I feel like Western board games are like, you're a hero, or you're destroying the world, or you're saving. And then German games are like, you're a lonely farmer trying to bale hay.
It's true.
Can you bale more hay than anyone else?
A great economy.
It's true. It's true. They call, among the sort of board game intelligentsia, those American games are called Ameritrash, because it's like this oftentimes really crappy gaming system on underneath a really fun idea of the, you know, the theme is this, oh yeah, you want to be you're a wizard and you're full of magic. And it's like, well, yeah, but the game sucks. Oftentimes not the case, but the reverse is true with the Euro games. It's where, you know, the systems are fascinating and deep and strategic and interesting. And the fiction upon which those are placed are really boring. But in this case, I guarantee you'll have a good time. It's a really complicated game. This is definitely on the more complicated, just kind of wrap your brain around it, takes a while, thick rule book side of gaming. But it is so much fun and so great. And I highly recommend if you've tried, you know, Settlers of Catan and Dominion and felt like you're ready to move on to something more, a little more complex, I always say next step, Power Grid. You will love it if you are patient enough to learn the rules. It's great. And there's, you know, it's best with more players, but they've come out with an expansion that's so clever. If you have fewer players, this expansion adds a player who is a robot and will play the game based on a series of rules like a robot, so that you can add another player that it basically plays by himself, but it's all done with cardboard and paper and cards. So pretty brilliant.
That's really interesting. I like that idea.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Again, very well supported game, so you can find lots of maps for it.
Where do you buy most of your games, Jeff? Like, is there, because people ask about, you know, getting into games, but I've seen your collection. I mean, is there a go-to place, or do you just kind of look in the internet and, you know, Amazon? Because like I'm even newer than Anthony is in this. Like Amanda, you know, likes the Boggle and Catchphrase and Cards Against Humanity. But then, like, you know, playing games with you and with James Stevenson, it's like, how do you get into this?
Well, Amazon is a good resource, but if you want to go to a dedicated, like not high end, that's the wrong word for it, but much more inventory, a place like Fun Again Games, if you search okay. for Fun Again Games, or Cool Stuff Inc. is another place that is great. But the best way, honestly, is to go to Board Game Geek. Board Game Geek is really mecca for anybody that loves these kinds of board games. It has links to every possible thing you could possibly want. It's a giant database of every board game ever. So that's a great pick. And again, every week I'm going to try to give people reasons to expand their tabletop experience, because I think it relates and they're really fun. And I think it will make you appreciate video games in a different way. And all these systems, there's a wonderful back and forth that happens between video game developers and board game developers. And there's an appreciation of all that stuff. So I'm trying to promote that.
Yeah, that's very true. Like I've noticed that as people get into board games, or as you have them play board games more, they begin to look past the sort of production design and sort of the things that you're presented as a player in video games, and start to really see the systems underneath, which is really interesting. Because it makes you a better player, and it makes you more appreciative of the games that you play.
Yeah, and in specifically in the case of this game, you start to understand how economies work. Basically, the whole game is predicated on this idea of supply and demand, which is a simple concept, and you know, anybody can understand it. But when you see it in play, and when you have to win or lose based on manipulating that system, you understand how things interrelate in a much more physical way, a much more tangible way. And I love that. That's why I love board games, is because I learn as I'm playing. I sort of figure out, oh, that is related to that, is related to that. And the rule set is really where the fun lies for me. So
I have an 06 tabletop, though, with an 07 Leaf, and I'm just wondering if it will support these games, or if I need to upgrade my Leaf or not.
Yeah, you might. It's going to be big. It's going to be, you need some space, bro. You need some room.
Do you have a 6 chair, or do you have an 8 chair after the Leaf?
I mean, it's expandable to 8 chair, but I didn't take the plunge because, you know, I just hate proprietary 8 chairs, and I'm like, really? Mm-hmm. Design within reach? Like, I have to use your chair catalog for the chair? And it's just, I just wish that someone would make, like, can chair cats get in and make some like third party compatible chairs for my tabletop? It's frustrating.
You need to go open source. You need to build your own table. That's what everybody's
doing.
That's
true. Yeah, there you go.
Get yourself right, some quality birch and get to work.
Son of a birch. That's going to do it for this episode of DLC. I really appreciate you hanging out with us, Anthony. This was really fun. A treat.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. The first episode was so great. This is such a great show, and it was funny. I was tweeting the whole time about how much I was loving it. I was listening, and I was tweeting to you, Jeff, and then to C. Spicer, who is not Christian at all.
Yeah, that was really funny. Somebody
atheist and just hates those tweets.
Somebody was like, "This is not me."
It's just this.
Stop.
It's this woman from Virginia Beach who was like, "I don't have a show. Stop saying I have a show."
Yeah, that was awesome that you were hanging out in the chat room last week. Really cool, and we're glad you got you on as a real guest. I'd love to have you back anytime you'd like. But in the meantime, where can people see your stuff?
If you're looking for more game related stuff, I do that on Rev3 Games. So that's youtube.com/Rev3 Games. We're going to be doing Adam Sessler and I will be doing a Nidhogg live stream tomorrow afternoon. So if you're interested in seeing that, that's where you go to find those things, the electronic diversions. And then all the science stuff is either on youtube.com/DNews or youtube.com/Hard Science Show.
Very, very cool. And what about you, Mr. Spicer? What are you doing this week?
This week. So if you're listening live and you're in LA, tomorrow night, Tuesday, I do this live show, and it's a podcast on the Nerdist Podcast Network called What's New, and it's the second Tuesday of every month is the live show at NerdMelt here in Los Angeles, and it's a fantastic show. Dan St. Germain, Mike Lawrence, both had Comedy Central specials last year. A good friend of mine, Zoltan Kassis, who just won the Seattle International Comedy Competition. I'm going to be there, so that, you know, gross a little bit, but it's a really cool show. It's a live show, and then, like I said, a podcast on the Nerdist Network, and then also my show Improv Versus Stand-Up. That is a monthly show at Upright Citizens Brigade Theater here in Los Angeles, and also hosted by a friend at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York. Look out for those, and we're doing some festivals. We're going to be in San Diego on January 29th doing the show down there, and then one of my favorite comedy festivals from awesome guy Zach Ward started this thing years ago. It's the North Carolina Comedy Arts Festival. We're taking Improv Versus Stand-Up out there February, I believe it's like right around Valentine's Day, like February 13th, 14th. If you're in the area, we'll go eat some barbecue and check out a show, and it's going to be great. But first, Jeff, we need to check out your show. What are you doing?
Me? I'm on stage. I'm on stage very soon in Los Angeles. If you're around, I am doing a production of The 39 Steps at the Norris Center, and then we're moving to Palm Springs to the Annenberg stage there. You can see that. I'm going to put the post up on jeffcanada.com. That's jeffcanada.com with two N's and one T. But if you're in the LA area, honestly, I don't say this every time, I promise, but this might be the best show I have ever been a part of. I could not be more excited about it. I think it's going to blow people away. And it's not because of me. It's because of the incredibly talented people I'm working with. So I hope people get a chance to come see it. I cannot wait. It has been a treat to work on. But that is for another time. We will be back Monday, 11 a.m. again, every Monday, 11 a.m. right here on 5by5.tv/live. Or if you want to download, well, you've already downloaded it, I hope. But hopefully you can hang out with us in the chat room or call in. I apologize for the difficulties with some of the calls today, but I'm glad we got that all worked out. Hopefully you'll hang out, give us a call next week. We have some really awesome guests lined up. Anthony is just the beginning of a really cool string of awesome people that are going to hang out over the next few weeks. We've got, who have we got coming up? We got Johnny English himself.
You haven't booked anybody, have you?
I just have to look at the list
right now.
John Davison, who tried to call last week, we've got him next week. And then Cody Banks, the executive editor of PC Gamer, will be the following week. It's going to be awesome, and I hope you guys hang out. Thank you very much for downloading the show and telling your friends. We will be back next week, same bat time, same bat channel. And until then,
give us a good review on iTunes.
Yeah, do that, and think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.